Midstream.
After the Israeli aggression on the Jenin camp and amid silence by the Jenin Brigade and the Palestinian factions, President of the Palestinian Authority Mahmoud Abbas visited the city of Jenin, apparently as part of a plan to regain control of the city. The visit, which is Abbas's first since he assumed office 17 years ago, sparked popular criticism of the authority in light of the enormity of the security measures that it surrounded it. Many residents sarcastically asked about the position of these forces in protecting the Palestinian citizens who were subjected to barbaric attacks just a few days ago, amid clear anger towards Ramallah, which was evident by chants in support of the Jenin Battalion. Before Abbas's arrival, 300 members of the Presidential Guard arrived in the city to secure the visit, not against any Israeli threats, but against whom exactly? No one knows. Meanwhile, the leadership of the Fatah movement mobilized its masses to show a kind of popular rally around Abu Mazen. However, local sources revealed that the number of those who participated in the reception of Abbas was meager and was estimated at hundreds, including citizens, individuals, and members of the security services affiliated with the authority itself. On the purpose of the visit, sources in the authority reveal that Abbas's move falls within the plan drawn up by security leaders to regain control of the Jenin camp, which includes strengthening the presence and power of the security services and carrying out a campaign of arrests against members of the Hamas and Islamic Jihad movements. So the man came in after 50 hours of brutal fighting, destruction, displacement, yet nonetheless unwavering victory to finish what Israel failed to achieve. The plan, which was approved by Abbas after his meeting with the leaders of the security services last week in Ramallah, requires starting the process of confiscating weapons, preventing armed manifestations in the camp, and carrying out arrest operations for a list of people from the city of Jenin in the first stage, up to the implementation of arrests in Jenin camp as a second stage. In return, Netanyahu is to present proposals for facilities in the interest of the Palestinian Authority, including the establishment of an industrial zone near Hebron, the granting of soft loans, the scheduling of Palestinian debts, the provision of fuel exemptions, the advancement of the date for the transfer of tax revenues, as well as an increase in working hours on the Al-Karama crossing, and returning the permits of the VIP visitors to the authority officials. Such an honor for Mahmoud Abbas, really. I'll just stop here before what I might say becomes inappropriate for broadcast. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas arrived last Wednesday in the city of Jenin and its camp to see the conditions of the citizens and the progress of work in the reconstruction of the camp after the recent Israeli attacks on the camp during Operation Jenin Force a few weeks ago. This step comes at a time when the Palestinian Authority and behind it the Fatah movement has become more aware of their declining popularity among the Palestinians, particularly in the city of Jenin and its camp. In addition to dozens of cases of collision between the security services against citizens and resistance fighters in the West Bank. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied Al-Quds is Mr. Adnan Najib, political commentator and head of the Beit Al-Maqdis news agency. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Adnan. Now, the Palestinian Authority aspires to restore this popularity through Abu Mazen's visit, and perhaps to open some sort of a new page with the local community in the city of Jenin and its camp as well, and to support the security forces inside the city. Now, they want to strengthen their position, especially after the emergence of the Palestinian resistance in the camp victorious as a retaliation against the aggression against the camp by the Zionists. Now, they are obviously reinforced by the popular environment, by the support of the people, and we saw that maybe the Palestinian Authority wants to grab that, hijack that. How do you assess the visit of Mahmoud Abbas last week to Jenin?
In the name of Allah, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful. Mr. Mahmoud Abbas's visit to Jenin government, specifically in the Jenin camp, is due to two main reasons, in my opinion. The first reason is to improve the bad image that has been imprinted in the minds of the Palestinian street in general and the Arab international public opinion. After the Palestinian Authority system, supervised by Mr. Mahmoud Abbas, has been shaken, especially after the recent visit by members of the Fatah Central Committee to the Jenin camp, during which the camp residents expelled those delegates on behalf of Fatah and the Palestinian National Authority. Therefore, the visit, in my opinion, is among the failed moves by the Palestinian Authority to try to restore its position in the West Bank. In light of the unprecedented failure of the Palestinian political leadership to defend its besieged people everywhere in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and dispersed in the countries of the diaspora.
One very important issue, Mr. Annan, was that Abbas's visit raises questions about the approach that the authority will be making towards the city of Jenin and the Jenin camp in specific in the upcoming next phase, because considering the occupation's pressure on it to play more of a role that the occupation itself cannot play, they're pushing Mahmoud Abbas to play that role, and the facilities that the enemy government intends and promises to provide to the Palestinian Authority in order to strengthen it and maybe help it regain its some of its prestige, let's say, inside of the city and the camp. Does that insinuate a possibility of a clash between the Palestinian security forces and the Palestinian resistance factions, especially in Jenin?
I believe that there is a state of awareness prevailing among the segments of Palestinian society in the West Bank. There is a popular mood that rejects the shedding of Palestinian blood among the sons of the security services and the sons of the resistance. Attempts to shed Palestinian blood are not new attempts. Not as long as the Zionist occupation, along with the United States of America, works hard to see a clash of Palestinian blood on the ground through internal fighting. But we as Palestinians who support the line of resistance count on the awareness of the resistance fighters to prevent us from being drawn into a series of spilled blood inside the Palestinian interior. But honestly, everything is possible. There is a fierce attack by the Palestinian security forces to detain the resistance fighters in all the governance of the West Bank. There are restrictions on the resistance fighters everywhere in the West Bank. Unfortunately, this increases the Palestinian streets' congestion towards the PA's security services. But as I said, we are counting on the awareness of the Palestinian population, so as not to be dragged into such battles, even if some try to drag us into them. And I mean here specifically the occupation and the Arab Zionists, and behind them the United States of America.
Well, Mr. Annan, the Palestinian security sources revealed that there was a regional American-Israeli agreement with the Palestinian authorities that was forged in Jordan and in Egypt, followed by intensive contacts to confront the growing resistance forces, especially in the West Bank. Many measures have been agreed upon with the Palestinian authorities, sadly, which include increasing deployment of the Palestinian Authority forces in Jenin and maybe entering the camp in the upcoming period, which leads to reducing the activity of the resistance. They hope that it would reduce the activity of the resistance in the camp. How do you think that will work out if the Palestinian Authority actually goes ahead and implements what the Zionist entity wants?
I believe that this agreement, which we have read in various media, is not new. The Palestinian National Authority has always concluded agreements with the occupation under the auspices of the United States of America, and with the partnership and sponsorship of some Arab countries such as Jordan, Egypt, and the Arab normalization countries in the Persian Gulf. Thus, this matter is not new to the Palestinian people, and it is not surprising that this comes from such regimes and authorities whom themselves are aware that their job is to defend this usurping entity. As I said before, we are counting on awareness within the Palestinian street in order not to fall into the trap of internal fighting. Although we see on the ground that there are preparations on the part of the Palestinian Authority, with its security services and also with its economic and social arms, in order to control specifically the Nablus government and Jenin government in the north in order to eliminate resistance. in order to control specifically the Nablus governorate and Jenin governorate in the north in order to eliminate the resistance. This resistance, which has proven in the past days and even in the past months that it is difficult to defeat and difficult to break. There are attempts to destroy it through the attack initiated by the entirety of the Zionist entity, with more than 1,000 soldiers armed with all the weapons known to humanity in order to eliminate a few dozen young fighters, in a geographical area of less than 1 kilometer. But this entity failed. Therefore, the national authority will not succeed, and agreements with Western countries will not succeed. And also, with the participation of the countries of normalization under the United States to eliminate the hawks of resistance in the occupied territories. A resistance that is not represented by a specific person or faction. Today it has become a culture and an idea spread among Palestinian people. The different segments of the Palestinian people have come to see the Jenin camp model and the old town model in Nablus as the model that must be followed in order to achieve our freedom from this occupation and reclaim our lands. Therefore, we count on the awareness of the Palestinian people and on the steadfastness of these resistance fighters. And we also count on the independent axis in the region, which we call the axis of resistance. As long as this axis fully supports the Palestinian resistance, as long as it acts as the arm and back for the resistance fighters in Palestine and in the occupied land, then I believe that more internal solidarity between the axis of resistance and the Palestinian people will thwart the plans of the occupation, the plans of the Palestinian Authority, and the plans of Arab normalization countries who aim to eliminate the resistance in the occupied land.
Definitely. Well, Mr. Anan Najib, it's always a pleasure having you with us. Anan Najib, political commentator and head of the Bayt al-Maqdis News Agency. Thank you very much for your contribution to our show. Please, ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we'll be talking about the relationship between Turkey and NATO. Before the last elections and the weeks and months that preceded them, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan threatened America, NATO, and the countries of the European Union and said more than once that he will not agree to let Sweden into the alliance. However, there was no real surprise that he retracted everything that he said, especially after his phone call with the U.S. President Joe Biden, who said a day after this call that he does support Turkey's accession to the European Union, but he thinks that this is a purely European matter. More details in this following report.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan surprised his allies in NATO before the NATO summit, which took place last week, by setting a new condition that seems difficult to achieve, which is opening the door to Turkey's entry into the European Union in exchange for Ankara opening the door to Sweden's entry into the alliance. Before the last elections and the weeks and months that preceded them, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had resorted to issuing threats against the United States of America, the NATO, and the countries of the European Union, and said more than once that he will not agree to Sweden's accession to the alliance. No one was surprised, though, that he retracted everything that he said, especially after his phone call with President Biden, who said a day after this call, "We support Turkey's accession to the European Union, but this is a purely European matter." This is what Sweden's Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson also said after Erdogan agreed to his country's accession to the alliance, promising him to lift the ban on Swedish military sales to Turkey, with other non-binding promises to coordinate with Ankara in combating terrorism, which is meant by the Turkish Kurdistan Workers' Party PKK and the YPG. At a time when the diplomatic community is ruling out that Erdogan will receive any support from the European Union, which Turkey has been waiting at its gate for 70 years. Now, the most important aspect of Erdogan's position is his provocation of Russia 2 days before the NATO summit. President Erdogan extended an urgent and surprising invitation to Ukrainian President Zelensky to visit him in Istanbul, to return from there with five of the most infamous leaders of the fascist Azov group, whom Moscow handed over to Ankara as part of a prisoner exchange deal, but on the condition that they remain in Turkey until the end of the war. The second Turkish provocation came with the agreement signed between the two parties, which includes building a military complex to manufacture and develop Turkish drones inside Ukraine, in addition to other areas of military cooperation. As for the third provocation, it came when Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan met with the leaders of the Muslim minority of Turkish origin in the Crimea region, which Ankara considers occupied by the Russians. Erdogan's announcement of his support for Ukraine's accession to NATO is the most important indicator of a possible change in Ankara's policies towards Moscow. Meanwhile, President Putin, who had previously complained about similar Turkish positions, including Zelensky's non-compliance with the Istanbul Agreement regarding the withdrawal of Russian forces from Kiev in exchange for a comprehensive Russian-Turkish agreement and with Turkish guarantees, is highly expected to cancel his scheduled visit to Ankara next month. With a potential Russian position to respond to the unsurprising change in President Erdogan's position, it remains to be seen if Ankara in the next stage will be on Washington's side more than it is now with Moscow.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Istanbul is Mr. Husni Mahalli, researcher in international relations and expert in Turkish affairs. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mahalli. Now, controversy continues to escalate over Erdogan's sudden approval of Swedish membership in NATO, especially due to his connection between the accession of the Scandinavian country and the revival of Turkey's accession into the European Union. What is your take on such a maneuver by Mr. Erdogan? And do you think that Europe will allow Turkey, in, especially at such a unprecedented times in European history, to join the European Union?
There is no maneuver because, one, Turkey has been a member of NATO for 7 years. Two, Turkey is a strategic ally of the US. Three, NATO has about 30 bases inside Turkish territory. What President Erdogan did was nothing but internal propaganda to deceive the Turkish people, as is the case in most other issues with regard to foreign policy. When he threatened the Emirates, Saudi Arabia and Egypt, then he returned and asked them to reconcile with him. With regard to Sweden, when he threatened Sweden under the pretext that it supports terrorism, as Erdogan said, he meant the Kurdistan Workers' Party and the Kurdish and Syrian People's Protection Units, as well as the preacher Fethullah Gulen. Erdogan knows that those who support this terrorism are the United States of America before Sweden. America is the one who supports the Kurdish militias in the east of the Euphrates. America is the one who supports the Kurdish militias in the east of the Euphrates and occupies the east of the Euphrates. And regarding the preacher Fethullah Gulen, whom Erdogan accused of planning and supporting the failed coup in 2016, Fethullah Gulen resides in the United States of America itself. So this position is not a serious one for President Erdogan. And as I said, it is nothing but internal marketing on the basis of national, religious and sectarian slogans to which the Turkish people are accustomed. To a point that the supporters and followers of Erdogan say that he is a world leader and the leader of the Arab and Islamic nation and whatnot, and that he is the heir of the Ottoman Caliphate. Even if he made a mistake, in their view, he knows why he made that mistake. That is, in their view, there must be an idea in President Erdogan's head, at least according to his followers and his supporters.
That's really interesting, because before the last elections and during the weeks and months that led to those elections, we heard Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, just as you said, threatening the United States of America, threatening the NATO, and also the countries of the European Union themselves, and said more than once that he will never accept Sweden into NATO. But how are his supporters and his foes as well? Because you just said that his supporters might give him some sort of benefit of the doubt of why he's doing what he's doing. But what about his foes? I mean, how are they receiving his sudden change of heart concerning NATO?
They never stand up to it. This issue or this question needs to be answered by conducting a social and psychological study of the followers and supporters of President Erdogan. simply because there is no logic in the stances that President Erdogan has taken in recent years, as he threatens everyone, then returns and reconciles with everyone. Exactly as I said with regard to Saudi Arabia, the Emirates and Egypt. Even former US President Donald Trump in 2019 threatened Erdogan and sent him a message insulting him and literally telling him not to be stupid. But Erdogan ignored this message and begged the United States of America so that Trump would send him another message to visit the White House. This is the case now with President Biden, as when Erdogan agreed to Sweden joining NATO. He wished that President Biden would invite him to the White House, and he will soon be fulfilled, according to media reports. As for the biggest lie, it was when he said that there would be a reward for Turkey for it, allowing Sweden to join NATO, which is that the doors of the European Union would be fully open to the Turks. The strange thing is that Erdogan's followers and supporters believe this, forgetting that Erdogan has no intention of joining the European Union because he does not believe it benefits him ideologically and religiously, because he believes that he is the heir of the Ottoman Empire that occupied half of Europe. Therefore, this approach is of course not serious, because Turkey has been waiting at the gates of the European Union since 1963. I repeat, this issue requires a social and psychological study.
Something that is very interesting that came out of Mr. Erdogan with his newest position was the provocation against Russia. It seems like he's challenging Russia on purpose. I mean, before 2 days just before the NATO summit last week, he extended an urgent and very surprising invitation to the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, to visit him in Istanbul, and he gave him five of the most infamous Azov leaders who were handed to Turkey by Moscow, but the deal was that they will stay in Ankara till after the end of the war, but that did not happen as well. That was just a couple of many other provocations against Russia. How do you think this episode of insulting Russia will end?
I do not think that the relationship between Russia and Turkey will deteriorate and end, because there is a long history between Russia as an empire and later as the Soviet Union and between Turkey. The age of this relationship is about 500 years old and witnessed about 16 wars, during which the Russians won 11 wars and Turkey won 5 of them. With regard to the recent developments as mentioned in the question, this is not the only provocation. We know that there is a strategic military cooperation between Kiev and Ankara, especially in the matters of military drones. And especially during Zelensky's recent visit to Istanbul, it was agreed to manufacture Turkish drones inside Ukrainian territory. However, we must remember that the provocation, as it is called, about the Turkish position against the Russians is not new. We know how President Erdogan did not abide by the Skopje Agreement on the issue of Idlib and northern Syria, just as he did not abide by the Moscow Agreement of March 2020. Also, with regard to the withdrawal of terrorist elements from Idlib, as well as sitting at the negotiating table with President Assad. But as I said, Erdogan did not abide by this issue, just as he did not abide by the tripartite special agreement between Turkey, Azerbaijan, Armenia and Russia regarding the situation in the Caucasus. The Turkish army is now in the Caucasus and it is a provocative position against the Russians. Likewise, President Erdogan's policies in Central Asia, where the republics are of Turkish origin, and we know that these republics are indeed Russia's backyard. This is also one of President Erdogan's veiled provocations against Russia.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you think those would do with the upcoming visit of President Putin to Turkey? Do you think President Putin might cancel his visit to Istanbul?
I think so. Although there are intense efforts by President Erdogan to appease to President Putin to visit Turkey as soon as possible, so that at least it is not said that Erdogan is the one who spoiled the Turkish-Russian relationship. Because this relationship has many very important aspects, the most important of which are the 4 nuclear reactors that Russia is building inside Turkish lands. In addition to that, Russia covers about 50% of the gas consumed in Turkey. So Erdogan is trying at least to tidy up the issue until he can arrange the matter strategically and not tactically with the United States of America, especially after his expected visit there, as well as arranging the situation of the regional security after his ongoing visit now to Saudi Arabia, Qatar and the Emirates.
Well, Mr. Hosni Mahalli is a researcher in international relations and expert in Turkish affairs. Thank you very much for joining us from Istanbul. It's an honor, sir, to have you with us to talk about these issues. Ladies and gents, thank you very much. I'll see you again next week on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remember the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
In the limelight.
More than 100 paramedics were injured by the Zionist regime forces while on duty last year. In 2019, an independent UN Commission of Inquiry stated that the West Bank and Gaza Strip, where the Zionist regime has targeted and killed on-duty paramedics, is one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a health worker. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime forces attacked medics during separate raids on two Palestinian refugee camps in the occupied West Bank recently. Troops shot a medic with the Palestine Red Crescent Society with two bullets in both feet while he was on duty in Askar camp near Nablus, the group said. In Nur Shan's camp in Tulkarm, occupation forces prevented the Red Crescent Society's ambulances from entering the camp. Troops also prevented an ambulance crew from transporting a woman in labor in Nur Sham's camp and detained the team for half an hour and ordered them to take off their bulletproof vests and clothes, the Red Crescent said. Just last week, medics with the Palestine Red Crescent Society were provided with bulletproof vests and helmets after nearly 200 violations against their teams were recorded in the first half of 2023. This includes physical assaults, targeting with live ammunition and other weapons by Israeli forces, and repeated obstruction while trying to reach and transport the wounded, said Medical Aid for Palestinians, the UK charity that provided the protective clothing. More than 100 paramedics were injured while on duty last year, according to the charity. In 2019, an independent UN Commission of Inquiry stated that the West Bank and Gaza Strip, where the Zionist regime has targeted and killed on-duty paramedics, is one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a health worker. In addition to the medic who was shot in the feet, a Palestinian was shot in the knee with live ammunition during the raid in Asker camp, according to the official Palestinian news agency Wafa. Wafa also reported in Nur Shams 4 Palestinians were injured by live fire. According to Wafa, 9 others were wounded by shrapnel, potentially as a result of a series of large improvised bombs that were detonated as military bulldozers entered the camp. Troops raided the camp's mosques and dozens of homes. Videos show powerful blasts in the camp that the Israeli regime military and Palestinian outlets said were caused by explosive devices planted in the streets, a new tactic recently used in Jenin. The Times of Israel also reported the Israeli military said troops detained 17 wanted Palestinians, seized weapons and neutralized explosive devices during raids across the West Bank overnight. The Tel Aviv Daily Haaretz said that in Nur Shams, Israeli troops were met with considerable gunfire and explosives that were thrown at them. Palestinians in Nur Shams rallied in support for the armed resistance after the Zionist regime military recently said Palestinians also confronted raiding troops with gunfire in Akbat Jabr camp near Ariha, according to Israeli regime media. Meanwhile, a bus carrying Israelis in the West Bank town of Hawara was struck by several bullets, causing no injuries. Hawara has been a flashpoint of violence by Zionist regime forces. In February, the town was stormed by Zionist settlers who set fire to vehicles and homes. A Palestinian man was martyred by Zionist regime troops during the rampage. Nearly 200 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli regime troops, police and Zionist settlers since the beginning of the year, with the majority of fatalities occurring in the West Bank. That figure also includes Palestinians who died from injuries sustained during previous years. Recently, 19-year-old Badr al-Masri was shot and killed amid confrontations that erupted during an Israeli regime raid that included police chief Kobi Shabtai at Joseph Tumi Nablus. Two more Palestinian teens were shot and killed the following day. Muhammad Fuad Atta al-Bayed, 16, was shot in the head by an Israeli regime troop in Umm Safa near Ramallah, the seat of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Defense for Children International Palestine said that the boy had joined a weekly protest against settlement expansion. The rights group said Umm Safa is surrounded by Jewish-only Israeli settlements encroaching on Palestinian land. It added its residents hold a weekly demonstration after Friday prayer to protest the expansion of Zionist settlements. Another Palestinian, 24-year-old Abd al-Jawad Hamdan Saleh, was shot in the chest and killed in Umm Safa earlier in the month during a settler attack on the village. Recently, Zionist regime troops shot and killed 18-year-old Fawzi Hani
Makhlafa near Sebastia in the northern West Bank, claiming that the teen attempted to attack Zionist troops with his car. The teen's family disrupted the Zionist regime's narrative of events and said that the car in which Makhlafa was traveling was ambushed by troops. Al Jazeera, citing local media, reported that shortly before the fatal shooting, Makhlafa had just passed his high school exams and was in good spirits.
Seven damage pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me brother Yasser Ibrahim we have reached the day of Tasu'a which is the 9th and the most difficult day of Muharram for the family of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. It is a day that for us, as those who are not there, we do not have the true understanding of what went on that night, the night before the day of Ashura. Some of the narrations that we have regarding that particular night are astounding. That people were laughing, people were smiling, people were preparing to meet their Lord in the best of manners. It's an amazing concept. The pictures that one can kind of imagine in their own minds regarding those companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam on that night. But what is also important to understand is those people who will be left behind. The family of Imam Al Hussein alayhi salam, Imam Zainul Abideen alayhi salam, Bibi Zainab salamullah alayha, Umm Kulthum salamullah alayha, and the others, the children. For them, it is a very difficult night. For those who will go to the battlefield tomorrow, they will be martyred. They will earn a high and lofty position in the proximity of their Lord. But those who will stay after, they will have to bear a great burden. They will have to bear great journeys, hardships, trials and tribulations. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala only knows the jaza and the reward and the status and the station that He will give to these individuals who, after witnessing all of that, still stayed strong and continued. So inshallah, in our next segment, we will be introducing a book regarding Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. So please stay tuned.
Hussein, there is no life without Hussein. There is no life without Hussein. There is no life without Hussein. Hussein, you are light of my eyes, and with your name I start to rise.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is titled The Mission of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. This book was written by Ayatollah Muhammad Yazdi, Rahmatullah alayhi, who also has passed away not too long ago. He was a great scholar, a great person who served Islam. And this is one of his early books. This book in its original Farsi form was banned for a while. And then it was translated into English and was printed in, alhamdulillah, at our disposal. So the book was then translated by Sayyid Ali Kuli Qurai. As you all know from the translation of the Holy Quran, it was the same translator. So the book was published by the Foreign Department of Bunyade Ba'tha. And it was published in 1987. And this institute was located in Tehran. And what is interesting in that the preface, right in the cover, it says that the publication of the book is left to the Awqaf institution by its author, Mr. Muhammad Yazdi. So the book was given as Awqaf. The book was translated and given by the author to the Awqaf Institute, that every single money that is made, it goes back to the Awqaf. He himself didn't collect anything. So the book, for example, goes through certain stages. Obviously, in the English translation, it is mentioned in the preface that some stuff of the Farsi was taken out. So one of the stuff that was taken out from the English that was in the Farsi, alhamdulillah, I happened to read this book, was that the reason for the majalis of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and the reasons for it, it was not something that should have been taken, it should have been kept. Because it's something that also throughout other places in the world, that kind of culture is there in certain places, but it's something good. But anyway. So in this particular thing, Ayatollah Yazdi speaks about the uprising of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the upholders of justice, Muawiyah's regime, Hussein leaves Medina, and so on and so forth, until he reaches Imam Hussein's last letter, the prisoners of Kufa. He mentions the court, he mentions the aftermath, he mentions the night of radiance and gloom, which is tonight, and hopefully, inshallah, it'll be very appropriate to read that particular chapter for our dear listeners in our next segment, inshallah.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. With me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. So the book that we have introduced to our dear listeners is titled The Mission of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. It was written by Marhum Ayatollah Muhammad Yazdi, rahmatullah alayh. It was translated by Sayyid Ali Kuli Qurai and published in Tehran by the Bi'asat organization, or the Foreign Department of the Bi'asat organization. So we would like to read from page 110, The Night of Radiance and the Day of Gloom. The sun set over Karbala, the sunset prayers were performed as usual, and the men went into their own tents. A strange silence hung over the place. Gradually, as time passed, the thirsty children were put to sleep. Zainab was by the side of her ill nephew, Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam, Husayn's alayhi salam eldest son. This is a historical debate of whether Imam Zain al-Abidin was the eldest son or someone else was the eldest son. Anyway, that's a historical debate. Who for several days had had a bad fever. The men who guarded the boundaries of the camp prepared themselves for their nightly duty. At this time, there came a call from Hussein alayhi salam, summoning his friends and companions. Hussein alayhi salam's voice reached his sick son in his bed. He requested his aunt to be allowed to move his bed nearer to the tent door and raise the curtain so that he could hear the words of his father and imam. In his 57th year of life, Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam had an angelic white face with grey hair and beard. Hussein alayhi salam started addressing his companions. After praising God with the inherited eloquence from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, he said, "I have not known of anyone's companions being more loyal and faithful than you. I have not heard of any woman and children more full of love than these. I hope that God will grant you the best of his rewards and the highest of compensations. I did not see for myself any more days of life. Life with the tyrants you have seen is devoid of any value for me. But I want to tell you this,
The darkness of night is a good cover. Nobody has anything against you. These people are thirsty for the blood of only one man, myself. Do not put your lives into danger, and all of you depart from this deserted place. Take my family, woman, and children, and leave this place. I most heartily give permission. I do not have the slightest objection to your departure. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make us of the true followers of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And inshallah, the day of Ashura, we are of those that truly show our bay'ah and truly become those who are Husayni in order to serve the Imam of our time, Imam al-Sahib al-Asri wal-Zaman. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
According to the Gaza Ministry of Social Development, 459 families were displaced as a result of the Israeli regime war. They are now homeless, totaling 2,516 people, including 1,180 children. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "On May 9th, the Zionist regime attacked Gaza with ferocity. For 5 days, it bombed the besieged Gaza Strip, killing 33 Palestinians and wounding hundreds more. Much of that horror, however, was not shown on television, especially in Western media. On May 13, 2023, the Naphan family received a phone call from the Zionist regime army, warning them of an imminent bombing of their residence, located in the neighborhood of Jabalia, in the besieged Gaza Strip. Palestine and Bilal Naphan are both 35. They have 4 children with special needs. That harrowing call terrorized them. Palestine told the Palestine Chronicle, "We were having dinner when the Israeli army called us and ordered us to evacuate our house in 10 minutes. Palestine continued, "Gripped by fear, I hastily dressed myself on the staircase. I also forgot to wear my hijab." Her husband Bilal told us that his first thoughts were focused only on the children. He said, "We only had 10 minutes to leave our house. Even for a healthy person, this is hardly enough. Imagine for a person with disabilities. I was not even able to take their medications and wheelchairs with me, Bilal said, with the sadness of that moment still lingering. The Naphan family's house, once filled with cherished memories, now lies in ruins. The family is now homeless. Palestine told us in tears, "Where can we seek refuge? My disabled children did not deserve such a fate." The Naphan family remains without shelter, since none of their relatives' houses could accommodate their large number. The Banat family also fell victim to the devastating five-day Israeli regime attack on May 9th, which destroyed their three-story home. Faraj Banat, 38, is a father of six. During the latest war, he was at the funeral of a relative when he received a call from the Israeli regime army. "I received a call from an Israeli intelligence officer. He ordered me to return home, and he told me that he could see I was at a graveyard," Banat told the Palestine Chronicle. Banat told the officer that he is a simple farmer with no connection to any resistance movement. The Israeli regime officer, however, was adamant. He said, "Go back and evacuate your family within 10 minutes. Banat requested more time to gather his belongings or clothes before the bombing, but the Israeli regime officer refused. Then the Israeli regime officer asked him to warn his neighbors because they intended to target the entire square, a reference to the whole block of houses. The officer told Banat, "I will bomb your house and your two brothers' houses." The Israeli voice on the phone seemed bereft of any humanity. The house, in fact, all the houses were destroyed as promised by the Zionist regime officer. Banat said, "More than 10 families are now displaced. Why did they bomb any house? My house? Other people's houses? Where should we live now?" Their financial situation does not allow the Banat family to find an alternative housing solution. Therefore, the family is now living in a tent in front of their demolished home. In Beit Lahia, in the northern Gaza Strip, another family is experiencing similar trauma. On May 12th, two Israeli regime F-16 destroyed a building belonging to the Taha family. In fact, this is not the first time the family loses their home due to the Israeli regime bombing. Samir Taha, 62, told the Palestine Chronicle, "During the 2014 attack on Gaza, they bombed my home. Our family remained homeless for 2 days before we could rebuild our home. And now, after all of that suffering, the Israeli regime occupation bombed our home again." Samir's son, Mohammad, told us that they were also warned 10 minutes before the bombardment to evacuate. Mohammad said, "More than 42 people lived in this building. We began running outside without taking anything. This is not humane." The Taha family plans to set up a tent in the proximity of their home until they are able to rebuild. Mohammad said, "Unfortunately, the tent does not protect us from cold and heat, nor is it able to protect us from stray dogs, but we have no alternative. I grew up in this home. I lived here and got married in it, but all our memories are lost now." In its continued attacks on the besieged Gaza Strip, the Zionist regime destroyed civilian infrastructure, buildings, and entire residential neighborhoods. Various international human rights organizations said that the Israeli regime has committed what amounts to war crimes. But this is what human rights experts often say. It neither prevented the Zionist regime from attacking and killing Palestinians, nor provided Palestinian victims with any justice or even shelter. Wafa News Agency also reported, according to the Gaza Ministry of Social Development, 459 families were displaced in the recent Israeli regime war. And according to these statistics, they are now homeless, totaling 2,516 people, including 1,180 children.
We say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
It's 2023, but child labor is still rampant in the United States. At least 10 states have introduced or passed laws rolling back labor protections in the past 2 years. Alongside slavery, the country has a history of using children as cheap labor. Illegal immigrant children are forced to work in order to survive. A Washington state law passed recently in April allows 18-year-olds to work in establishments for 21-year-olds and older people, such as bars. Many states in the U.S. have no infrastructure in place to track minor children who are working nor their work conditions. Child labor, a social issue you often hear about and associate with poor countries, is not merely a relic of history. It continues to persist within the borders of the United States. This distressing reality raises serious concerns about the protection and welfare of children in America. Despite advancements in labor laws and regulations, certain industries and sectors exploit the vulnerable, robbing them of their childhood and future prospects.
Children have been an important part of the labor force throughout human history. But in the 19th century, this became a problem due to industrialization, as children were exposed to dangerous working conditions. Employers, however, saw a huge benefit to the use of child labor. Children were smaller and more nimble, and so therefore could perform functions that would be more difficult for adults. In addition, it was more difficult for children to unionize, and employers could pay them lower wages than they had to pay adults.
Child labor, although widely condemned, still lurks in the shadow of American society. In agricultural settings, children toil under harsh conditions, often performing hazardous tasks that jeopardize their health and well-being. Additionally, the service industry witnesses an alarming number of young workers as restaurants, retail establishments, and domestic households exploit their cheap labor.
Corporations are bringing back child labor in America. And some Republicans want to make it easier for them to get away with it. Since 2015, child labor violations have risen nearly 300%. And those are just the violations government investigators have managed to uncover and document. The Department of Labor says it's currently investigating over 600 cases of illegal child labor in America. Major American companies like General Mills, Walmart, and Ford have all been implicated. Why on earth is this happening? The answer is frighteningly simple. Greed. Employers have been having difficulty finding the workers they need at the wages they're willing to pay, and rather than reduce their profits by paying adult workers more, employers are exploiting children. The sad fact of the matter is that many of the children who are being exploited are considered to be them rather than us because they're disproportionately poor and immigrant. So the moral shame of subjecting our children to inhumane working conditions when they ought to be in school is quietly avoided. And since some of these children or their parents are undocumented, they dare not speak out or risk detention and deportation. They need the money. This makes them easily exploitable.
The consequences of child labor are far-reaching and deeply damaging. Not only does it rob children of their right to education and play, but it also exposes them to physical and psychological harm. The long working hours and dangerous